Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. It's been a long time, brothers and sisters. It's been, well, since the beginning of, since May, actually. And I apologize for the delay, how long it's been since I last put out an episode. I know I've done this before, but yeah, like it's been a very busy time for me. Here I am in China working. I was working pretty hard. I was dealing with final exams. Exactly running final exams at the university where I'm working. It was a lot of work. It was busy. It was busy times. The end of the semester is always a busy time. So we're through that, and now we're here making a new episode of the show. And a lot to touch on. A lot has happened. Of course, we had the 12-day war of Israeli aggression against Iran. We had Iran's retaliation, strong retaliation against Israel. This was probably the heaviest series of blows that the apartheid state has suffered in the course of this, the genocidal violence that has gone on for the past 2 years. You know, Tel Aviv was hit. Very, very important Israeli defense and intelligence installations were hit. Iranian missile capability was very highly demonstrated, its proficiency, its power, its lethality. And Israel basically was forced to back down. Like, they launched this surprise attack against Iran. They killed top Iranian generals, top American, top Israeli, Iranian scientists, hundreds of Iranian civilians. And they clearly were trying to decapitate the Iranian government in this attack. And it completely backfired. It completely backfired. I mean, in the end, after 12 days, Israel more or less had to back down. It had pretty much run out of missile interceptors, missile defense interceptors. Its ability to defend itself was seriously compromised. And it was running out of weapons. It was running out of weapons. And one of the reasons for this ceasefire, which took place between Iran and Israel, is because Israel basically couldn't defend itself anymore and it needed to pause. This certainly isn't the end. I mean, you can tell, like, Israel's going to come back. I mean, Israel's incredibly aggressive. It will almost certainly fight against Iran in the future. But right now it can't. It needs time to resupply. I mean, it seems like American weapons originally destined for Ukraine are actually now being rerouted to Israel as Israel rearms, restocks, and all this talk about a ceasefire in Gaza, if it's real. I mean, I'm very skeptical of Trump whenever he talks about trying to put together a ceasefire in Gaza. He's done that before, and we saw where that went. We saw the betrayals that took place. We saw the carnage. We continue to see the carnage just ramping up every day, with new heights of or new depths of horror, I should say. And basically, if there's a ceasefire now, it would just be temporary. Israel needs time to rearm so it can go in again and continue the carnage and the slaughter and the genocide. It's pretty grim. It's pretty grim. But we see the limits of what the United States and Israel can do. Like, they have clear material, concrete limits of what they can do. And eventually, yeah, they do have to back down. They need room to breathe. Fighting against so many opponents, so many resistance movements that continue to fight back on all fronts, is not an easy thing for them. This genocidal military is running out of supplies. It's running out of gear. It's running out of weapons. And of course, fighting against Iran at the same time. A country of 90 million people, far bigger than Israel. That was just a bridge too far. They couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. So, yeah, a lot has gone on over the past month. But I mean, we need to continue to focus on Gaza, because the genocide is still going on full tilt. Some of the atrocities going on there, like, oh man. It just rips at your soul. It like rips tears your heart out seeing this kind of stuff. And I'm just gonna let Nora Barros Freeman of the Electronic Intifada describe, and I'm amazed she does this every week in and week out, with the Electronic Intifada podcast, which you should all be listening to, because it pretty much gives the best information, best updates on what's going on. I don't know how she does it, but, like, yeah, her description of what's going on in Gaza pretty much, yeah, just illustrates the depths of brutality that are going on there, but also the heights of resistance as well. And we need to remember that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to play that clip from the Electronic Intifada podcast, the latest podcast, which came out last Thursday, I believe. So please stay tuned.
Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has bombarded areas across Gaza this week, killing 630 Palestinians and wounding more than 2,300 between June 25th and July 2nd in airstrikes, tank shellings, and by snipers, in attacks on residential buildings, tent shelters, cafes, and at U.S.-run so-called aid distribution sites. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said today, Thursday, July 3rd, that 118 Palestinians were killed and 581 injured since Wednesday evening, including 12 people killed and 49 injured at the U.S. and Israeli-backed aid centers, it added. Since late May, when operations at these U.S.-Israeli sites began, 652 starving Palestinians have been killed trying to obtain food aid. 24 people were killed on Wednesday trying to obtain a box of food. We'll have more on the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation in a few minutes. The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated on June 30th that the Israeli military had issued yet another displacement order for people in areas of Jabalia and Gaza City in northern Gaza, affecting at least 150,000 Palestinians, and followed other orders in central Gaza just days before. People are being pushed into overcrowded areas where thousands of others are already staying, the UN adds. These spaces lack shelter, water, and sewage systems, as well as adequate medical facilities. And they are being bombed. On Tuesday, July 1st, at least 17 Palestinians were killed when Israel bombed a building housing forcibly displaced families in the Zeitoun neighborhood of Gaza City. Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's civil defense, said that Israeli forces bombed 25 homes in Gaza City on Tuesday alone. Bassal added that the Israeli raids resulted in the deaths of 70 people that day, including 11 people waiting for aid, 12 children and 14 women, in addition to more than 200 wounded, some of whom are in critical condition. EuroMed Human Rights Monitor said that 5 people, including 2 children, were killed when Israeli airstrikes attacked the tents of displaced people in Al-Mawasi, west of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, also on Tuesday. Al-Mawasi is where Israel has ordered Palestinians in the north to flee. Journalist Nahed Hajjaj documented the aftermath of Tuesday's attacks from the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza City and spoke to a 10-year-old boy, Zain, who is taking care of his wounded younger siblings. That was a clip by reporter Nahed Hajjaj in Gaza City on Tuesday. On Monday, June 30th, Israel bombed the crowded Baqa Cafe on the seaside in Gaza City, killing more than 30 Palestinians, including children, and those gathering for a child's birthday party. The cafe was a gathering spot for families who sought a moment of rest from the bombings and for journalists who needed internet access and a place to charge their phones. A survivor of the attack, Ali Abu Atayla, who was inside the cafe when it was bombed, told the Associated Press that, quote, without a warning, all of a sudden, a warplane hit the place, shaking it like an earthquake. Ismail Abu Hatab, a photojournalist who worked with various media outlets and who organized photo exhibitions outside Palestine, was killed in the bombing. The Gaza government media office said that Abu Hatab is the 228th reporter and media worker to be killed by Israel since October 2023. Also on June 30th, the Israeli army bombed the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah for the 12th time in 21 months. The government media office said that Israel targeted a tent for displaced persons inside the hospital compound, resulting in injuries and material damage to the medical facility. Al Jazeera's Tarek Abu Azoum reported from the site.
Israeli military has just targeted Al-Aqsa, the courtyard of Al-Aqsa Hospital at the moment. This has been a huge explosion and there are people inside. The Israeli military till now did not warn this area before it was struck, and the hospital is in a state of emergency. As we can right now see, this is a makeshift tent that was struck. and rescue operation are just trying to take place at the moment by several defense members.
That was Tarek Abu Azoum reporting on June 30th at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in central Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli and American forces continue to use the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation aid distribution sites as killing fields. Since the private U.S.-led mercenary company began operations just over a month ago, at least 652 Palestinians have been killed, more than 4,500 Palestinians have been injured, and dozens remain missing while trying to obtain meager amounts of food. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated this week that, quote, through the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, Israel has introduced a new killing mechanism cloaked in a humanitarian facade, further escalating the genocide in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli army's targeting of starving people near distribution centers has become a systematic daily practice, carried out openly before the world, with international silence perpetuating impunity and allowing this dangerous pattern to continue unpunished, the rights group added. This occurs as the international community, states, and institutions remains unable to take serious action to hold Israel accountable for its crimes, compel it to permit independent relief organizations to resume their work in the Gaza Strip, and lead humanitarian efforts that ensure the population's vital needs are met while safeguarding their lives and dignity. Doctors Without Borders said that the U.S.-Israeli scheme, quote, is slaughter masquerading as humanitarian aid and must be immediately dismantled. An emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in Gaza said, quote, the four distribution sites, all located in areas under the full control of Israeli forces after people had been forcibly displaced from there, are the size of football fields surrounded by watch points, mounds of earth, and barbed wire. The fenced entrance gives only one access point in or out. GHF workers drop the pallets and the boxes of food and open the fences, allowing thousands in all at once to fight down to the last grain of rice. If people arrive early and approach the checkpoints, they get shot. If they arrive on time, but there is an overflow and they jump over the mounds and the wires, they get shot. If they arrive late or they shouldn't be in there because it's an, quote, evacuated zone, they get shot, the worker added. On July 1st, more than 160 non-governmental organizations operating in Gaza issued an urgent call for immediate action to end the slaughter at the military-controlled food distribution sites. Quote, concentrating more than 2 million people into further confined areas for a chance to feed their families is not a plan to save lives, the joint statement said. These areas have become sites of repeated massacres in blatant disregard for international humanitarian law. Orphan children and caregivers are among the dead, with children harmed in over half of the attacks on civilians at these sites. With Gaza's healthcare system in ruins, many of those shot are left to bleed out alone, beyond the reach of ambulances and denied life-saving medical care. The groups demanded that third-party states not fund these militarized schemes, but instead support the restoration of, quote, a unified UN-led coordination mechanism grounded in international humanitarian law and inclusive of UNRWA, Palestinian civil society, and the wider humanitarian community to meet people's needs. This past week, the U.S. State Department approved $30 million in funding for the shadowy U.S.-based Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, with Reuters reporting that the U.S. could approve the same amount every month for an indefinite period. Sources speaking anonymously to Reuters said that the State Department, quote, exempted the foundation, which has not publicly disclosed its finances, from an audit usually required for groups receiving USAID grants for the first time. The foundation, which is reportedly based in Delaware but has no clear paper trail behind it, attempted to register an affiliate in Geneva, but it came under legal scrutiny by the Swiss government over its failure to fulfill legal requirements to operate in Switzerland, Reuters reported, including having the correct number of board members, a postal address, or a Swiss bank account, none of which were provided. Swiss media reported on Wednesday that the Swiss Federal Supervisory Authority for Foundations ordered the formal dissolution of the Geneva affiliate of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Part of the plan had to go through Switzerland to try to attract funding under the banner of Neutrality and International Geneva, a central hub of international diplomatic missions, reported the Swiss broadcaster RTS earlier this week. According to information from the RTS investigation unit, a network of business agents helped find a Swiss representative, in this case, a lawyer with a presence in Geneva. International business partners with whom he regularly dealt convinced him to provide the foundation with an address and a representative in Switzerland as required by law. Journalists approached the Geneva lawyer to respond to information that was beginning to leak from the United States and Israel about the reality of the foundation's plan, which was more military than humanitarian, RTS reported. The lawyer resigned the same day that an article in the Swiss newspaper Le Temps was published. The lawyer said that he resigned after realizing that international business partners had approached him without providing him with full information about the reality of the plan surrounding the foundation. That administrator was never active with the foundation, and no bank account had ever been opened, RTS added. While people are killed every day at these so-called aid sites, and as thousands of tons of food, medicine, fuel, and supplies remain trapped on the other side of Israeli checkpoints just kilometers away, Palestinian children are dying of starvation. The Gaza government media office stated on June 28th that at least 66 children have been killed as a result of malnutrition and Israel's policy of deliberately depriving children of baby formula, nutritional supplements, and food. As the Electronic Intifada's senior editor Maureen Claire Murphy recently reported in her article, No Truce on Horizon as Gaza's Children Starve, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights warned that hundreds of infants and premature babies face life-threatening danger amid a shortage of therapeutic milk. Fortified milk is essential for infants with certain health conditions, but supplies have run out at Gaza's neonatal intensive care units and have all but disappeared in local markets due to Israel's severe restrictions on what enters Gaza's crossings, Murphy wrote. Dr. Jamil Suleiman, the director of Al-Rantisi Hospital in Gaza City, told the Associated Press that fortified formula required for newborns is out of stock and that many mothers, quote, are unable to breastfeed due to severe malnutrition. An American doctor told the French publication Le Monde Diplomatique that in preparation for his recent travel to Gaza on a medical mission, he had packed his suitcases full of basic medical supplies such as gauze, bandages, and sanitary pads, and several cans of baby formula. Once he arrived at the Allenby Bridge crossing, Israeli officers searched his bags and confiscated the baby formula. The coordinator of the medical convoy, Diana Nazal, told Le Monde, quote, the baby formula was confiscated. What other explanation is there if it's not that hunger is being used as a weapon of war in the ongoing genocide in Gaza? Physicians and women's healthcare workers have warned of the accelerating crisis for breastfeeding women and their newborns on previous episodes of the Electronic Intifada live stream and podcast. The ongoing ban of fuel into Gaza will imminently shut down essential facilities, the UN warned on June 30th, and will impact hospitals, water and sanitation equipment, telecommunications, the movement of cargo from crossings, and the operation of community kitchens. Already, the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza reported that Al-Shifa Medical Complex has suspended its kidney dialysis services due to fuel shortages, and that intensive care services will be limited to a few hours each day, the UN added. Al Jazeera reporter Hani Mahmoud stated on Tuesday that Al-Shifa Hospital, quote, was once the largest healthcare facility in Gaza, but has slowly turned into a waiting room for death, not just because of the war wounds, but because of a lack of fuel that keeps everything running. This showed that survival in Gaza is not just about escaping the airstrikes, but also about keeping the power on so patients can survive, he said. On January 25th, the World Health Organization said it was able to deliver its first medical shipment into Gaza since March 2nd, a small convoy of 9 trucks carrying essential medical supplies, 2,000 units of blood, and 1,500 units of plasma. The blood and plasma were delivered to Nasser Medical Complex's cold storage facility for onward distribution to hospitals facing critical shortages, amid a growing influx of injuries, many linked to incidents at food distribution sites, said the WHO spokesperson. However, Dr. Izzedine Shahab, a physician and writer in Gaza, announced that this week that saline has run out at the Al-Ahli Hospital in Gaza City. He writes, quote, "There is no medicine left here, not for the body, not for the soul. I have long spoken of the disintegration of Gaza's hospitals, how we labor beneath roofs that leak shrapnel, beside beds where children lie half alive. The World Health Organization calls it a collapse. Collapse is too gentle a word. This is annihilation. Today at Ahli Al-Arabi Hospital, we lost the last of our saline. Yes, saline, salt and water, the most elemental tool of medicine. Without it, we cannot hydrate the sick, cleanse a wound, keep a child alive through the night. Without it, our hands are not healing hands. They are hands that bury the living. This morning, a boy was carried in, limp and burning with fever. His father had wrapped his leg in a torn t-shirt soaked with old blood. We had no IV solution, no sterile wash. We used boiled water and a prayer. I looked at the boy's eyes. He did not cry. He had passed beyond crying. In another room, a mother whispered that she feeds her infant boiled lentil water, not out of neglect, out of poverty, out of starvation. Formula now costs more than the monthly aid they no longer receive. She cradled her child with the tender silence of someone who has already rehearsed the funeral. You want numbers? I will not give them. Numbers dehumanize. They make the dead easier to digest. Instead, I give you this: the sound of a child gasping through dust, the look in a nurse's eyes as she realizes she has nothing left to offer, the quiet, unbearable dignity of a people condemned to die tidily, without spectacle." Those are the words of Dr. Izzedine Shahab, writing from Gaza City. One of Gaza's leading doctors was killed along with his family in an Israeli airstrike on their tent shelter in Gaza City on Wednesday. Dr. Marwan Al-Sultan was a cardiologist and the director of the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza, and was the 70th healthcare worker to be killed in the last 50 days, according to Healthcare Workers Watch, speaking to The Guardian. Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, the director of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City and a longtime colleague of Dr. Sultan, said that, quote, "he was a prominent scholar and one of the two remaining cardiologists left in Gaza. Thousands of heart patients will suffer as a result of his killing. His only fault was that he was a doctor. We have no option but to be steadfast, but the sense of loss is devastating." International human rights organizations have renewed their calls to release Dr. Hossam Abu Safiya, the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital, who was abducted by Israeli soldiers at the end of December 2024 and remains in Israeli detention. Dr. John Koller, the co-founder of the Chicago-based medical organization Med Global, spoke to NBC News on June 26th and said that he was, quote, "very afraid that Abu Safiya won't make it out alive from Israeli jail." Abu Safiya was Med Global's lead physician in Gaza. The organization said that 5 other members of its medical staff are among the approximately 180 civilian health workers from Gaza still held without charge in Israeli prisons. In a new joint statement, 23 civil society organizations, including GLIA, Human Rights Watch, Doctors Without Borders, Physicians for Human Rights, and Médecins du Monde International Network, are calling for the immediate release of the imprisoned health workers. On June 29th, Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya was awarded the 2025 Human Rights Award by the Palestine-based Lawyers for Justice organization, which said, quote, "This award aims to shed light on the sacrifices made by human rights defenders, particularly in the face of the ongoing genocide against civilians in Gaza and the suppression of freedoms. It also seeks to highlight the suffering of political prisoners and those who defend dignity under fire and bombardment." We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight how a new vocabulary is emerging in the genocide by Yusuf Al-Nono, writing from Gaza. Yusuf talks about many new words, quote, "that are making their way into our vocabularies, words that we must now use to match the many unbelievable situations we find ourselves in. We are living in a surreal reality with new Gazawi vocabulary to match," he writes. "Gaza was not a quiet place before the war, but people got used to the annoying sounds of al-zanana, or drones. But I don't think we will get used to the sky-splitting roar and high-pitched screeches of the fighter planes that fly overhead. In December 2024, my friend Mahmoud and I were chopping wood for a fire. I had not known Mahmoud for a long time. He was displaced from the nearby Al-Karama area. He was forced to stay at his aunt's house in our neighborhood because his house had been destroyed by an Israeli attack. After a short time, I got to know him a little better and we became friends. Nearby, a group of children were playing as we chopped wood, and then we all heard the abrupt and terrifying shrieking sound of the jet. We covered our heads and got low to the ground, anticipating a missile strike. The children were terrified, and their little bodies shook with fear. They also thought it was a missile coming for us and started screaming. I tried to calm the kids down. I told them it was not a missile, that it was an F-16 that had come very close to the ground in order to confuse people and spread fear. Mahmoud said to the children, 'Don't be afraid, the plane shahatat.' Before that day, I had only heard the verb shahat in the context of a car screeching to a halt, like when a car travels at a high speed and suddenly slows down. The loud noise that follows, that is from shahat. Now I understand the word in a different way. Every time I hear the sound of a plane ripping across the sky, I say shahatat, shahatat, to calm myself." Those are excerpts from Yusuf Al-Nono's feature, How a New Vocabulary is Emerging in the Genocide, on electronicintifada.net. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. Photojournalist Haneen Salem took these photos of a group of boys in Gaza. She says, quote, "In a courtyard shattered by war and stripped of all signs of life, I found children sweeping the rubble with their tiny hands, trying to bring back a place that was once a playground. They ran barefoot after a faded ball, as if chasing days that haven't arrived yet. I walked closer and asked one of them, 'Aren't you scared of the drones?' He looked up, breathless, and said, 'When did we ever stop playing?' I smiled, not because the place was safe, but because their souls still believed that playing here in Gaza is the purest form of survival." And that's from the photojournalist Haneen Salem. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Nora Barrows Friedman of the Electronic Intifada podcast, talking about the current situation in Gaza and just highlighting the imperative that we stand with Gaza right now, that we stand with Palestine, and that we oppose imperialism, we oppose empire, we oppose apartheid in all its forms. Now, what I want to transition to now is I want to transition to a talk given actually in May by Dimitri Lascaris, a Canadian lawyer and anti-imperialist. And what it really talks about is something that really is really nefarious, this whole relationship between America and Israel, and how they kind of cover for each other and kind of do a good cop, bad cop kind of tactics, in the media, especially. And Dmitry referred to this as Kabuki theater. And given the talk now, I mean, there's been talk for months about like this ceasefire that never materializes in Gaza. And even though this is from this talk is from back in May, I think it's still absolutely relevant now, given how Trump has been handling the situation and just all the talk, the endless nonsense in the media. So I think it's still absolutely relevant. So I'm going to play that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Good day, this is Dimitri Lascaris coming to you from Kalamata, Greece on May 12, 2025 with my latest rant of the week. The subject of my rant this week is going to be Kabuki theater. Now, for those of you who've been following my commentary on this heinous genocide in Gaza that's been going on for about 19 months now, you'll be familiar with my use of that phrase. Basically, what I mean by Kabuki theater is the elaborate spectacle that the Biden administration engaged in during the time that Israel was committing genocide on its watch. In that spectacle, Biden and his underlings like Antony Blinken and Jake Sullivan purported to be concerned about the conditions in Gaza, purported to want Israel to provide sufficient humanitarian aid, and to engage in some kind of a ceasefire that would secure the release of the hostages and at least minimize the killing, if not bring it to an end altogether. But in fact, the Biden administration was simply pretending to be seeking all of those things. That was my position. And in fact, we ultimately received confirmation of this when former Israeli ambassador Michael Herzog made a startling admission recently. And what he said was, quote, "God did the state of Israel a favor that Biden was the president during this period. We fought in Gaza for over a year, and the administration never came to us and said, ceasefire now. It never did. And that's not to be taken for granted." Now, folks, if that doesn't prove that the Biden administration was engaged in Kabuki theater, I don't know what does. But here's the particularly maddening thing about all of this. That Kabuki theater did not begin with Joe Biden. It has been going on for decades. I go back all the way to the administration of the elder Bush in the period around 1990. The Bush administration at that time was purported to be frustrated and deeply chagrined by the Israeli government's refusal to cease settlement expansion in the West Bank. But despite its purported frustration, it did absolutely nothing of any efficacy in order to bring the settlement expansion to an end, the most obvious option available to it being a suspension or outright termination of the provision of military aid to Israel. It simply refused to use its leverage to achieve what it purportedly wanted, which was no more settlements in the occupied West Bank. Then came Bill Clinton. We heard the same rancid bullshit line from the Clinton administration as well. Again and again, we were told how frustrated he was with settlement expansion, but he did absolutely nothing to bring it to an end, even though the tools for him to secure that objective were readily available to him, primarily a suspension or termination of military aid to Israel. Then we get the administration of the younger Bush, otherwise affectionately known as W. W was purported to be furious with the Israeli government when it compared the Bush administration's supposed opposition to settlement expansion to Nazi appeasement. Did the Bush administration do anything to actually effect a termination of settlement expansion and ensure the realization of this supposed dream of the two-state solution that U.S. leaders have claimed to have been seeking for decades? No, it did nothing of any substance. It did not pull the plug, not even a suspension of military aid to Israel. Then we get Obama. And there probably were real tensions between Netanyahu and Obama, particularly around the subject of the nuclear negotiations with Iran, resulting in the JCPOA and which allowed Iran to engage in very limited forms of uranium enrichment for a period of 12 years, after which it would be free to engage in uranium enrichment without restriction, but subject to its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, so that was real tension, of course. But at the end of the day, even though Obama didn't particularly seem to like Netanyahu, and even though they had a tussle over the whole question of the Iran nuclear deal, Obama never did anything to actually force Netanyahu to stop attacking Iran or to end settlement expansion within the West Bank. On the contrary, just as he was heading out the door, Barack Obama entered into the richest military aid package for Israel in U.S. history, $3.8 billion a year over the period of a decade. Now, some will point out that just before he ended his second term, Obama instructed his officials at the United Nations not to veto a resolution, which a UN Security Council resolution, which condemned Israel's settlements. He didn't vote in favor of it. He simply refrained from vetoing it. But this was not the first time that the UN Security Council had adopted such a resolution. In fact, both it and the General Assembly had adopted many resolutions over decades condemning Israel's settlements in the West Bank as a violation of international law, and also condemning its annexation of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, and its annexation of the Syrian Golan Heights. But nothing came of any of that because the United States ensured that none of these resolutions was enforced. And so too was that the case in respect of the resolution adopted in 2016, just before the departure of Obama from the White House. It effectively was a toothless resolution that accomplished nothing. At the end of the day, Barack Obama did exactly what Israel wanted. He continued to supply weapons despite its flagrant and innumerable violations of international law. So this whole notion of the U.S.-Israeli kabuki theater is one of long vintage. And this brings me now to the second Trump administration. We've been hearing more and more over the past several weeks of the Trump administration's supposed frustration with and disappointment in Benjamin Netanyahu. And it all got off on a sour note, one might argue, when Trump, just before returning to the White House in January of this year, shared a tweet from Professor Jeffrey Sachs, in which Jeffrey Sachs described Benjamin Netanyahu with complete justification as a deep, dark son of a bitch. And of course, there was a temporary ceasefire in Gaza, but we soon came to understand that the Trump administration had absolutely no interest in trying to rein in America's rabid Israeli attack dog. It began to deliver 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs to Netanyahu. It allowed Netanyahu to treat the ceasefire agreement like toilet paper, sending its forces into Rafah, refusing to evacuate its forces from Rafah as it had agreed to do, and resuming the relentless bombing of Palestinians and the destruction of the civilian infrastructure and even the outright starvation of the civilian population. All of that resumed under Donald Trump, and he just kept pumping more and more weapons into the genocidal entity. But now we're hearing things like Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, has been effectively fired. He's being moved off into a much less important role at the United Nations. And there's a lot of speculation that the reason for this is because Waltz was conspiring behind Donald Trump's back to ensure that the Trump administration pursued Israel's agenda. Now, there's been no official confirmation of that. And as far as I can tell, that is sheer speculation. But whatever the reasons may be for the dismissal of Michael Waltz, there are some other things that are going on, which people are arguing is indicative of a rupture between the Trump administration and the regime of the suicidally psychotic war criminal, Benjamin Netanyahu. For one thing, the Trump administration came to an agreement to stop bombing Ansarallah and Yemen in exchange for Ansarallah's commitment not to attack U.S. shipping. And what is notable about this is that the agreement apparently did not forbid Ansarallah from attacking Israel itself, and it has continued to do that since the agreement was entered into. So many are arguing that this is a very significant piece of evidence of a rupture between the Trump administration and the Israeli regime. There's also the fact that Pete Hegseth, the U.S. Secretary of State, or Secretary of Defense, I should say, just canceled a previously scheduled trip to Israel. At the same time, tomorrow, May 13th, Donald Trump is scheduled to arrive in Saudi Arabia, where he's going to hold talks with the Saudis that will not include, at least not directly, any representatives of the Israeli government. And there are reports that the Saudis have requested that representatives of the governments of Syria, Lebanon, and the Palestinian Authority be included in those talks and will be included in those talks. And there's speculation that the Trump administration is willing to do some kind of a deal with the Saudis that will be of significant benefit to the United States and that will not ensure Saudi normalization with Israel absent a concrete commitment to the two-state solution on the behalf of the genocidal entity, which is something, of course, that's never going to happen. So I've seen a lot of people arguing, particularly in the alternative media, that this is indicative of a rupture between the Trump administration and the Netanyahu regime. But I have to tell you, folks, at the end of the day, the one thing that matters the most, and really the only thing that matters in assessing the state of U.S.-Israeli relations, is the fact that the United States continues to supply the weapons to Israel that it is employing not only to commit genocide against the Palestinian people, but to engage in heinous acts of aggression against Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and others. So what are we to make of all of this? Well, one school of thought is that the frustration and the sometimes outright anger on the part of various U.S. administrations over the decades is genuine. It's very real. But that at the end of the day, one U.S. president after another was unable to do what he believed was in the interests of the United States because of the power of the Israel lobby. And of course, the most prominent proponents of this interpretation of the historical record are John Mearsheimer and Steve Walt, who've written a seminal work on the power of the Israel lobby in the United States. On the other side of this debate, you have people like former U.S. Secretary of State Chief of Staff, Lawrence Wilkerson. He was the Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who say that, in fact, the Israel government does exactly what the United States government wants it to do and is, in effect, America's rabid attack dog in the region. As many of you will know, I am definitely in the Lawrence Wilkerson camp on this particular issue. I would point out that the power of the lobby, at least in an economic sense, which is really what matters, it is, after all, about the bucks, is not particularly great relative to other lobbying organizations in the United States. Just take a look at this list of the top 20 lobbying groups by expenditure in 2025. You'll see that AIPAC, the principal Zionist lobbying organization in the United States, about which so much is said, doesn't appear anywhere on that list. There are many more lobbying organizations and interests that have far more economic clout than does AIPAC. And in fact, I'd go so far as to say that the most powerful lobby group in the United States is what we collectively refer to as the military-industrial complex, which benefits enormously and in fact depends for its very existence upon wars. And what country on God's green earth today is more responsible for war, for destruction, for the consumption of military goods than Israel? Israel not only starts and provokes and perpetuates wars and has been doing this for decades, but it convinces the Americans to get involved in massively destructive wars in order to pursue or advance an agenda that is favored by the government of Israel. For example, George W. Bush's criminal invasion of Iraq. So if you ask me, the military-industrial complex is likely to be exercising a far greater degree of control over U.S. policy in West Asia than AIPAC and all the other Zionist lobby groups put together ever could. So my interpretation, which I will defend until the cows come home and until somebody shows me evidence to the contrary, is that the reason why the U.S. Government consistently engages in this kabuki theater is because it doesn't want to be blamed for the heinous crimes of Israel. By going to the press, oftentimes through anonymous sources, and leaking that the U.S. administration of the day is frustrated in or disappointed with or furious with the Israeli government, American presidents and their inner circle put distance between themselves and the crimes of Israel. And they'll trot out this narrative that, well, Israel lives in a very tough neighborhood and its whole reason for existence is to provide a sanctuary for the Israeli people. And the Holocaust, one of the greatest monstrosities committed in human history against a marginalized people. All of these things are justifications for U.S. support for Israel, notwithstanding its unsavory tactics. And we don't like it. And, you know, we wish Israel didn't behave this way. But at the end of the day, we're going to support Israel anyways, because that's just the right thing to do. And it's necessary for the survival of this sanctuary for the Jewish people that's been set up on the land that God promised to the people of Zion. That's the narrative. It is all just designed to exonerate, to some degree, U.S. administrations for the ultimate responsibility for Israel's crimes. At the end of the day, my friends, all that matters is that the United States government, and this is true of the Trump administration, continues to provide the weapons to Israel with which it is blowing apart Palestinian children before the eyes of the world. And as long as it continues to supply those weapons, not to mention plenty of other economic aid, not to mention political cover, not to mention protection from prosecution for war crimes by international tribunals, then all the rest of this is just noise. All the claims that the Trump administration is angry, that it's frustrated, that there's a rupture, it's just noise. Now, I don't want you to interpret my commentary, my skepticism about the U.S. government's willingness to rein in its rabid Israeli attack dog as a pessimistic outlook for the Palestinian people. In fact, despite my horror, one which I'm sure you share, at what is being done to the Palestinian people, I believe that victory is at hand. But the victory will not come about as a result of the U.S. government's sudden determination to do the right thing. No, it's going to come from the Palestinian people themselves and from the resistance groups in West Asia that are supporting them, principally Ansar Allah, and from the pressure being applied on Western governments and international institutions by people of conscience around the world. The Israeli entity is becoming exhausted. Its military is almost an open revolt. In the last 3 weeks, there have been 4 or 5 officers of the Israeli military who have been killed in Gaza. Many others have been wounded, and that's just what the Israeli government is admitting to. Over 100,000 reservists are refusing to show up for duty. Israeli soldiers are signing, pilots are signing petitions calling for an end to the war. There are hostages who are putting out videos from the dungeons of Gaza, excoriating the Israeli government for continuing these wars. The protests are getting larger and larger. The economy of Israel is buckling. The state of Israel has been completely delegitimized in the eyes of billions of people across the world, including in the West. The days of the genocidal entity are numbered, my friends, and its demise is at hand. The liberation of the Palestinian people will happen within our lifetimes, but it won't be because any United States president has the conscience necessary to bring it to an end. Now, before I sign off from my latest rant of the week, I just want to update you on the challenge that I issued to 25 prominent Zionist lawyers last month to debate me on the issue of whether Israel is committing genocide. As yet, I have not had a single acceptance of that challenge from any one of these prominent, well-heeled, and highly experienced advocates. And as I've said before, I'm going to repeat it now, I don't believe that this has anything to do with my superior debating ability. They are every bit as capable, hell, maybe even more capable than I am of debating a position. The reason why they won't accept my debate, folks, is because they know that the evidence against Israel is so overwhelming that even an inexperienced law student could kick their ass in a debate over the question of whether Israel is committing genocide. That is why none of them has taken up this challenge. But if one of them eventually summons the courage to debate me in circumstances where they are doomed to lose because of the monumental evidence of Israel's genocide, I'll certainly let you know, and I'll be very happy that someone has finally accepted that challenge. For now, this is Dimitri Lascaris signing off from Kalamata, Greece on May 12th, 2025.
When the generator's on, till the cops said move along.